the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sunny like nobody else can, and of course that was Francis Sinatra. The night he hosted the Tonight Show took over for Johnny Carson, who would never book me on his show, but I was the first one Francis booked, and I thanked him eternally for that. And Happy New Year to you all. I know I'm 9 days late. It's January the 9th, 5 p.m. in John Barber's world here. But I want to wish you all a really, really happy, productive New Year. And as you all know, today, everybody's talking about something that does not really matter in our lives. Another celebrity, Meryl Streep. Actually, two celebrities, if you count Donald Trump. From long, vast experience, let me tell you, Hollywood is filled with probably the most cowardly Americans in the country. Actors and actresses making more than they deserve for speaking the words of writers, not being paid what they deserve. And as such, knowing they've not created their own dialogue, that their own words depend on others, they are reluctant to speak at all because most of them are inarticulate boobs. Our government has been involved in over 60 years of fake wars and horrors around the world and in our own land, about which all of these actors constantly remain silent. Three times in about 50 years, I can recall someone speaking up at one of these ceremonies. Marlon Brando, cowardly, through a lady named Sasheen Littlefeather, over the hundreds of years of mistreatment and treaty breaking by our government with the Indians. Taboos. Michael Moore winning an Oscar and justifiably bashing Bush over Iraq. To more boos. Now Meryl Streep bashing Donald Trump and being cheered. What Meryl should have been talking about was Sophie's Choice or Voter's Choice. In the film Sophie's Choice, a Nazi gives her the choice of saving one of her two children. That was the horrible choice she had to face. Now look at the horrible choice you and I had to face. She should have been talking about the Nazi choice given to us, the American voters, over Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. That was the horror that you and I had to face. Instead, like all cowards, she chose the easy way out, the easy target. For this, Meryl Streep should get no People Choices Award. We ended the last year with a writer I believe is the smartest political writer in America, Chris Hedges. I am thrilled to beginning the new year with a man I believe is the bravest, most interesting political activist in the country. How he got that way is an amazing story in itself, since most of his career was spent inside the belly of the beast for 27 years with a central intelligence agency. In the 80s, elevated to the chairmanship of intelligence estimates, preparing briefings for President George Bush, receiving a medal upon retirement, and then returning shortly thereafter to bite the hand that fed him for all those years, protesting the CIA's use of torture. For me, he is one of the big three in the world to go to find out what is really going on in our own country, America. The other two are Julian Assange and Ed Snowden. Fortunately for us, my guest stays here, suffering the slings and arrows of the outraged establishment, taking both verbal and physical abuse. It indeed is a privilege for me, after all this long time of wanting to talk to him, to be talking to him tonight, and it's a privilege for you to be listening to Ray McGovern. Ray, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, John. You're most welcome. Glad to be with you.
Well, Ray, before we get to talking briefly about your own productive and large family now, what was your background like? Because you ended up going through a pretty nice university when you went to Fordham. What were your parents like? What were your brothers and sisters like, if you had them? And when you were a youngster, was it, I'm sure you didn't plan on ending up with the Central Intelligence Agency. What were your dreams as a kid?
Well, I came out of an immigrant family in the Bronx of New York, and I used to walk to school there where Fordham University is. Graduated in 61 with a degree in Russian studies. The Army put off my call to active duty. I was commissioned in the ROTC for a year so that I could get my master's degree, and then I did my 2 years with the U.S. Army. It was just before Vietnam, and in 64, when I mustered out, it was a very natural progression to go into the CIA as an analyst on Russian, actually Soviet foreign policy.
Why did you keep Russian to study? Were you in any way influenced by your parents?
Well, yeah, I suppose I was, because my dad was the only person that thought that was a good idea. My counselor said, well, you know, that if you like it, go ahead. But I didn't quite trust my counselor. So I talked to my dad, and he said, yeah, you know, college is for all manner of things. If you enjoy the Russian, go ahead. And I did, and so I did. 4 years, and I taught it for a while at Fordham and also the University of Virginia. And it was a great preparation for what I ended up doing. I was the chief of the Soviet foreign policy branch for a while and had a number of people working for me who were quite good. One of them's name was Bobby Gates. He's since known as Robert M. Gates, and he's had all kinds of jobs, including head of the CIA and most recently Minister of Defense, or Secretary of Defense, I should say. So there were all kinds of bright people in my branch. Some of them were more disruptive than the others because they were more ambitious, and Bobby Gates fit that category. But he succeeded in becoming my boss in 10 years, and so I guess you can't fault him for that.
Ray, were you recruited or were you looking to join them? Did you approach them and say, listen, I'm an expert on Russia, you know, since we're having problems with Russia, why don't you hire me? How did that come about?
Yeah, it was the latter. I had read a really interesting book about the real reason for CIA, and that was to have one place, one central place, therefore Central Intelligence Agency, where all the information on a given issue or country would come into one inbox. And when I explained to college people today that we had inboxes made out of wood, you know, they shrugged their shoulders in disbelief. But that's the way it was. And the other big thing, of course, was that I was free to analyze that information, whether it was from intercepted messages or photography from space or you know, our own spies, the State Department, wherever it was from, I put it together. And on my little account there, it was Russian relations with China. And so there's a great deal of interest in that, especially during Vietnam. And so it was true. I was able not only to get all the information I needed, but then to make cogent judgments. And if it were a front burner issue, which it often was on Soviet foreign policy, what I wrote would get to the president the next morning with only corrections for my terrible spelling and sometimes syntax. If they agreed with what I said, that's the way it would go. And that's what President Truman envisaged. And I had career protection, well, for knocking
Did you have anything to do, to say, or write about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution? And in retrospect, when you look at that back at what obviously was admitted to as a manufactured lie,
that's
making
right.
Vietnam a fake war, what were your thoughts about the Gulf of Tonkin at the time, and what were your feelings about Russia at the time, and our attitude toward Russia, and did you really think that Cold War was necessary?
Well, on the Gulf of Tonkin, I learned later, well, I learned actually just a few days later, that there was no incident on that second day, that LBJ very much wanted to use this as a reason to get into open war with North Vietnam to start bombing the heck out of them, and that he didn't care whether there was an incident on the second day or not. Matter of fact, McNeil Lehrer had McNamara himself and McGeorge Bundy and some of the other people together after McNamara wrote that book. And McNeil said to McGeorge Bundy, now, how'd that work on that second day after the attack? What happened the next morning? And Bundy, you know, a patrician family guy who came out of Harvard and was a dean actually there and wasn't going to be out in the street looking for a job, he says this. He says, well, when the president came in, he said, well, Mac, and the president's a big guy, you know, and he said, well, Mac, are you going up there to sell that resolution to Congress today or not? And I said Bundy, well, sir, there's a lot of questions as to whether anything happened yesterday. And he looked at me and he said, Mac, are you going up to sell that resolution or are you not? And so what'd you do? And Bundy says, I went up and sold the resolution. So that's how corrupt it was then. It's still pretty corrupt depending on the political vicissitudes that are at work at any given piece of time.
Well, you were deeply entrenched at the CIA at the time of John Kennedy's assassination, and you brought up McGeorge Bundy, who was the military advisor to John Kennedy and was supposed to be Alan Dulles's eyes in the White House, which I certainly do believe. He wrote and drafted a memorandum on November 21st. It wasn't signed till Sunday. Johnson signed it on Sunday. But it was a memorandum reversing the policies of John Kennedy, his avowed public policies in his conversation with Walter Cronkite on CBS when he said he was going to withdraw the 12,000 advisors, 1,000 at a time. At the time of the assassination, did it ever cross your mind that some of your boys may have been involved?
No. But now it has. And now, regretfully, yes.
Okay, now hold on. We'll get back to that. Let's move fast forward a bit. We come to Iraq. Was this around the time you were made chairman of intelligence estimates? And what indeed are intelligence estimates? And what did you do with such a lofty title?
Well, I chaired a couple of estimates, one on Italy and one on Spain, actually, in the 70s when things were going all apart in those parts of Europe. I was not chairman of the Board of National Estimates. That was somebody who was my supervisor. But the estimates are a very important work of art because they include all the agencies involved in intelligence in the U.S. government. Now, there was one on Cuba in September of 1962 that was wrong. It said, oh, the Russians would never try to put missiles in Cuba because they know what we would do. Well, that was mirror imaging. That's really bad analysis. And, of course, we did discover that they were putting missiles into Cuba. And 20 years later, we learned that those missiles were armed. Those missiles had nuclear tips on them. And so if JFK hadn't stood up to the generals, you and I might not be having this discussion today. So fast forward. Now, there's an estimate that's going to be prepared on Iraq. It's the fall of 2002. There are lots of alarms about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction, but no estimate. And so the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Bob Graham from Florida, he says, look, if you guys are not willing to go on record with a national intelligence estimate, we're not going to allow a vote on this war. So what happened? George Tenet, who was the snivelly head of CIA at the time, went to the White House and he said, you know, we've put off this estimate for as long as we can. We didn't want to do it because we know how it would come out and that wouldn't fit in with what we want to do to Iraq. What should I do? And they said, well, I guess you have to do an estimate, but two conditions here. One is it has to come out exactly the way Vice President Dick Cheney said it was.
Oh, my.
On the 26th of August, so 6 weeks before. And it has got to be done in 10 days. Whoa. So I can just imagine, John, being in the director's conference room where I spent many hours, and the lieutenant coming back to his major lieutenants and saying, okay, we've got to do an estimate now. It's got to be done in 10 days, and it has to come out exactly the way Cheney said it was, namely that they had reconstituted their nuclear weapons program and had all manner of chemical and biological in the whole nine yards. So we have to do it 10 years because in 10 days, because the president wants to force Congress before the midterms to approve this. So now,
some critics of that presidency may be right that Dick Cheney was the Edgar Bergen to George Bush's Mortimer Snerd. So I would ask you, I read that you actually did briefings for sometimes daily briefings or weekly briefings for George Bush. Is that true?
Yeah, they were daily. We had this publication six mornings a week, the President's Daily Brief. It goes back to John Kennedy. We took great pains to do a good job on that, an honest job and something that a president could read in a reasonable period of time. And under the Reagan administration...
So, if you wanted him to read it, did you write it in crayon? Did you get to meet George... Did you get to meet George Bush?
Oh, yeah. He was a friend of mine. This is the senior Bush we're talking about.
No, I'm talking about George Bush, the Dick Cheney...
Oh, the little guy.
Control.
No.
The little guy. Did you ever get to meet him?
No. And I was gone by the time he arrived, and the curious thing was that when he did arrive, I was taken aback because the people that under his dad used to be called the crazies. I'm talking about Wolfowitz, I'm talking about I saw them coming back. And this time, his dad was able, that is Bush's dad, was able to keep them in places where they couldn't do much harm. Now Wolfowitz is the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Richard Perle is running his Defense Sciences Board. So they're all in key positions. So I wrote to the dad, and I said, Mr. President, I have great anxiety that your son might not know as much about these people as he needs to know. Would you tell him simply why we used to call them the crazies when we were?
Oh,
you
know, wow! Do you still have that letter? Did you ever publish it? Oh, how wonderful is that? Now you stayed until you retired, and you got a commendation medal when you retired. Was there some time before your retirement that you thought, I've got to leave this place? Or did you think, I better hang out until I get my retirement check?
Well, there were three things, the reasons I retired. It was right after the Berlin Wall fell down and the Soviet Union kind of imploded. Now, I was a Russian expert, so I clapped myself on the back. I said, good work, Ray. Mission accomplished. And that was one incentive to leave. It's kind of the pitch to be an expert on a country that doesn't exist anymore. The other thing, and more important, was I wanted to work down in the inner city, which I do now. And the third thing is because I became 50 years old, and I had spent enough time overseas to qualify for an early out, which meant an immediate pension, although greatly reduced, but at least immediate. So I've been able to supplement that by the work for the nonprofit
with all the anti-CA and anti-government stances that you take, which I want to get into very quickly here, were you ever threatened with a reduction of your pension?
Yes. Now, this was not an overt thing. When I gave back my commendation for meritorious service to Pete Hoekstra, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, 2 months later, I'm driving up to Princeton University to give a little talk, or a big talk, actually. There's a good crowd there. And there's a NPR report comes on that both the National Defense and Authorization Act is being prepared now, and the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has included a provision which would empower the head of National Intelligence to reduce or remove the pensions of former intelligence operatives. I took note of that, and then I mentioned that in my speech, and Rush Holtz, who was a congressman from Princeton, from New Jersey, was there. And he got up, he said, "That can't be true." And I said, "Well," he said, "Why do you know that?" I said, "Well, I heard it on NPR." He said, "Well, I don't know anything about that."
Okay.
Wow. Okay. So it
Ray,
was
have
true.
Ray, have you ever heard of somebody named Fuzzy from Langley? Fuzzy Krongard?
Fuzzy Krongard? Yes, yeah, sure I have, yeah.
Do you know him?
I don't know him. No, he was after my time, but he was...
he is on the phone, and it's just a surprise to me, but the CIA...
He's on the phone now?
Okay, Fuzzy, do you mind coming in and talking to us? Are you there?
I'm not the real Fuzzy, but I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
Is this your son Joe? Is this Joe calling?
No, Buzzy Krongard is the next director of CIA, right?
So you're not the real Fuzzy?
No, I'm not. I just thought you'd get a kick out of it.
I'm going to have to cut you off. I'm sorry, because I have a lot of things I want to talk to Ray about, but thanks. If you scared me a little bit, thanks for the little scare and happy new year to you. Okay, Ray, back to you.
Sure.
You're 50 mm-hmm. years of age. You're married, and how many children do you have?
5.
Oh, my God. So give me quickly their ages and names.
Well, right now, they go from 52 down to 3. And they're our kids. I'm talking about my grandchildren now. Sorry, I got them mixed up. The kids are 52 to 39, and the grandchildren go from 27 to 3 years old.
I was going to say, if you had a 3-year-old, you better conduct a DNA test right there, I'll tell you. what is the tipping point for you that makes you turn around and openly attack so articulately and passionately your former employer, the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, John, it's really quite simple. People ask me when I fell off my horse. Well, I didn't fall off my horse. It was a direct line. In other words, I work to tell the truth to our country's leaders. When I saw that my former colleagues had let themselves be suborned into... not mistaken intelligence, John, but fraudulent, creating fraudulent intelligence for the express purpose of deceiving our elected representatives out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. Well, that's as bad as it gets. And there were lots of other folks that felt the way I did, and that's when we formed Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Our first memo was on the day of Colin Powell's speech. We gave him a C-, and we warned the president that he really ought to get some other advisors who had more guts and who were less devoted to starting a war against Iraq.
You know, I've seen a lot of despicable things in the country, but one of the things that really saddened me the most, because it was not justified or it was not warranted. Tell me about what happened the day you silently protested Hillary Clinton. Go into detail and tell me what happened, please.
Yeah, well, I was in an audience in a small auditorium at GW University, having purloined a ticket from a member of the faculty whose name I won't mention. And I was listening there respectfully, waiting for her to appear. She was 20 minutes late. And when she came in, she had this incredible ovation from the whole crowd. And they all stood up and they were clapping. And it got a little bit noxious because no one would sit down. And I'm having this flashback, John. I spent time in the Soviet Union, right? And when one of these Soviet leaders would speak, everyone would have stormy applause. Matter of fact, in front of the next day, after each paragraph, it would say, "Burni applaudismenti," just like that, which means stormy applause. Everyone stands. So I said to myself, wow, what am I doing here? What am I clapping for? This woman is responsible for all manner of suffering in the world. And this was even before Libya and places like that. So I took off my outer shirt. I had the only clean undershirt I had on that day was the Veterans for Peace shirt, and that worked out pretty well because I turned my back and looked at the end of the auditorium. Didn't say a word, didn't make a motion, didn't do anything except stand with my back to her. Next thing I know, after about 2 minutes, this great big guy looked like a Redskins reject. He comes waddling down the aisle in front of me. And before he gets to me, I get taken down from behind by a guy I never saw. He had a uniform, but I never saw the uniform on him. I was scooped up, lifted over the three women between me and the aisle, and taken out.
They lifted you up? They physically lifted you up?
Yep, and they took me outside where they could do a job on me. They closed the doors. Now, Hillary Clinton...
Well, hold on a second. People, you said do a job. Did they strike you in any way?
I had lacerations all over my body when they got me outside. It was
they beat you?
Well, they put on these two sets of steel manacles or handcuffs, and it was pretty bad. I started bleeding profusely. I said, "Hey, give me some gauze." And they said, "What'd you do?" One of the cops said, "Well, I pricked my finger." They took me to jail, and I was in jail for several hours before I got out. But the interesting thing was that the theme of Hillary Clinton's speech, she was Secretary of Defense, State at the time, was the need to respect dissent in Iran.
Oh, my goodness gracious. It's like Dr. Strangelove. Oh, my God.
You got it. Something out of Camus, you know.
My God.
She didn't miss a syllable. It was really quite... I was just about 10 yards in front of her, and it's all on film.
What was the reaction of your wife and your children to this? Did they say, "Hey, honey, stop doing this"? What did they say?
Well, they know better than that. But you know, I had one call from the jail, you know, and I got my wife's answering service, and I just said, "Well, you know, I'm going to be home a little late, and but I'm fine, you know."
Oh, my goodness gracious.
But I had no money. No. Yeah, go ahead.
When it got down to the bottom of the barrel and we found Hillary and Donald down there, what were your thoughts about the election? What are your thoughts about the outcome? And what are your thoughts about Trump? And I'll just throw this out to you. You know, I'm telling you, I did not vote for Trump. I'm not a fan of Trump. I'm not a fan of anybody who takes pride in saying they never read a book, but I said to somebody, I hope he reads a book before January 20th, and it's a book on law, and he throws it at Obama and puts him in jail, because it looks like Obama and the CIA and media are trying to sabotage his presidency and create trouble with the Soviet Union. People don't realize the 1% got rich on fake wars and munitions. Donald Trump got rich on negotiating as a businessman. And I think what the establishment, correct me if I'm wrong, and if your former buddies at the CIA are wrong, but I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to create more friction with the Soviet Union, more than a Cold War, because they look upon Russia as a target, and they think that Donald looks upon Russia as probably a customer. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to agree with you. Now, with respect to the choice between Trump and Hillary Clinton, I was in Germany during the election, and in the days before, they were saying it's eine Wahl zwischen Pest und Cholera, which means it's a choice between plague and cholera.
I could only agree,
and I voted for Jill Stein. Actually, I advised her when she had questions, and she asked me to do an endorsement before the election, which I did. And what I said was that, it's really a choice between my grandchildren not having enough clean air or clean water, and the other option being someone who might lead us to a nuclear war where my grandchildren would perish much more quickly.
I tried a number of times to get Jill on the show. I never got a response from her. What were your thoughts about her going to Michigan and demanding recounts on the vote? Did you talk to her about...
Yeah, I didn't... Not really, not about her decision. You know, I had a relationship with her by that point where I trusted her. And I took her at face value when she said, look, if we don't look into these machines now, they're notoriously unreliable, when are we going to have a chance to do that? Next 4 years? Next 8 years? And so I took her at her word. And I couldn't really understand how anyone could think that Jill Stein was flacking for Hillary or anybody else. And of course, she didn't get very far because there was a great opposition to what she was trying to do. But how can you be against a fair count of votes? So that was my gloss on that. And, you know, I don't profess to be an expert on domestic policy. But,
Ray, when we started, I said we were going to talk for about a half an hour. You're just too interesting to let go. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, I'm going to introduce you to my cohort. His name is Joe Satilli. He is by far one of the best informed and most articulate real journalists in the country. Used to work for PBS. He puts out the best newsletter, the most objective, best written, best researched newsletter in the country. It's called News Vandal. His name is Joe Satilli. And when I come back, I'm going to have him join us because he's going to love talking to you. And I want your impressions on Julian Assange and Ed Snowden. So we're going to take a brief break right now, and we'll be right back again with Ray McGovern and Joe Satilli.
Thank you, John.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, this is John Barber. Welcome back to John Barber's World with the absolutely wonderful Ray McGovern. And now you're going to meet my cohort, somebody I couldn't show without, the second brightest man in America, to me, Joe Satilli. Joe, Happy New Year and welcome to the show. Joe.
Yes.
Did you hear me say Happy New Year and welcome to the
show? No, I wasn't on the show yet. Now I'm on the show.
Oh, I'm sorry. That you missed a great introduction. Joe, first I want you to meet Ray McGovern. Say hello to Ray.
Well, Ray, I'm a fellow denizen over at Consortium News, usually under J.P. Satilli.
Oh, okay. I recognize that from your comments.
Yeah.
Oh, that's one. Okay, now, you heard me at the top of the show. Your news vandal is absolutely terrific today. I mean, everything is a great story. Your comments and observations about what I opened up with about Meryl Streep and Donald Trump and the People's Choice Awards.
Well, you know, infotainment and politics have finally merged. You know, today what we have is People magazine actively debunking Donald Trump's claims that all of the ball gowns in D.C. have been sold out. That's where our discourse is. One, Donald Trump just pulled this thing out of his posterior that all of the ball gowns have been sold out in D.C. because his inauguration is going to be a star-studded, jam-packed jamboree of celebrities, which it's not. And then you have People magazine fact-checking him based on his Twitter attack. I mean, everything is so bizarre. I have this new theory that we've actually finally achieved representative democracy. I mean, sadly, this may actually be who we are in some ways, to have this orange, you know, spray-tanned, self-absorbed, self-aggrandizing. You know, you mentioned, John, he was a businessman, but he actually made his money by gaming tax loopholes.
Yeah, the system. He gamed the system. Okay, when I went to the break, Joe, I asked Ray to, when we came back, to comment first of all on Julian Assange, who was interviewed at some length, I believe, on MSNBC the other day, and Ed Snowden, and then I would like you to join him
sure. In
making comments about what people are saying about Julian Assange. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, I had the pleasure of having dinner with Julian 4 days before the election. He has
Where were you?
At the embassy there, the Ecuadorian embassy in London. I had been at Oxford doing one of those debates, and then I came down. When I'm in London, I usually do that with Julian. This time he said he might not be able to spend the whole evening because he was sort of busy.
And of course,
this was the busiest time. So anyhow, he has this pallor about him as though he hadn't been out in 4.5 years, which happens to be the case, okay? But he was just so lively. He was so kind of inspired because he was doing his mission. His mission is the same as ours, to spread some truth around. And he had had this wonderful interview with John Pilger earlier in the day, denying that Moscow had anything to do with the release of these emails. And he felt really, really good about it. And so we had a nice, relaxed dinner together for about 2 hours. None of us knew, of course, that Hillary was not going to make it. I got to Germany when I saw that. The Germans were completely out of, you know, they were so disoriented, they don't know what to do still. So, yeah, Julian is the real deal. And as I was telling somebody earlier today, you know, what he did was saved up and put in searchable form these Democratic National Committee, the DNC emails, which he had gotten through a leak, not through a hack, okay? And he had put them up out for people who could read them. Now, this happened 2 days before the Democratic National Convention. My God, who is terrible for Hillary? So what happened? First thing that happened, the first five people on the Democratic National Committee quit. Does that tell you something? Okay, second thing that happened, that they're trying to figure out what to do, and somebody says, well, I know what we do. We'll blame it on Russia. And somebody else said, well, you know, it wasn't Russia, it was Julian Assange. Oh, that's okay. We'll blame it on, we'll say that Julian's working for Russians. And then somebody else said, well, yeah, but what's the rationale? Oh, come on, the rationale is the Russians want Trump to win. It's a winning strategy. And indeed, this was the most magnificent diversion. You know, you talk about a magnificent obsession. Well, this is a magnificent diversion. New York Times, Washington, the whole media.
Yeah, but you know what, Ray? It is a diversion on the part of the media, but it's the same mistake they made in bashing Trump and supporting Hillary before the election. They are doing what they're told, that through social media and tweeting, America is not listening to them. So they may think they're doing the right thing, but they're not. Joe, your comments and observations on all this.
Well, I'm actually really curious about the state of the intelligence agencies, particularly the CIA. And as somebody who is involved and an astute observer, Ray, to what extent is the CIA neutered at this point? It's almost not functional the way it was. I mean, the CIA that we think of when we think about sort of the nefarious CIA, is that CIA gone? Is it a matter of has the culture changed? Do they find themselves in a catch-22 when they want to push an intelligence finding, and because they can't reveal sources and methods, and because nobody trusts their sources and methods, they essentially can no longer cajole the American public the way that they used to?
Well, it's a matter of them being completely complicit with John Brennan, who, for some reason, has this kind of hold on our president. If you watch, you look at the mistakes that Obama has made in the last 8 years, you can usually pin it right on John Brennan if it has anything to do with either intelligence or with foreign policy. And so when you look at these reports about the Russians doing the hacking, they're made out of whole cloth. There is no evidence, no real evidence, even in these memoranda that they released over the weekend, that the Russians were involved in hacking. There's an alternative version, that is, the real version, and that is it's not a hack. See, a hack has to go over the network. NSA intercepts everything. I know it boggles the mind, but it's true. They intercept everything they can tell the sender and the recipient of every email. So if it went over the network, NSA would have it. They don't have it because it didn't go over the network. It was leaked. Now, who leaked it? Well, there is a young worker for the Democratic National Committee. His name is Seth Rich.
Right.
And he was killed early in the morning on Washington Street on the 10th of July.
An apartment explosion.
Pardon?
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
So what happened next is what's interesting, and that is Julian Assange, in an interview with a Dutch TV program, said, and I quote, "This shows the risk that whistleblowers continually run." And then he said, "WikiLeaks offers a $20,000 reward for information leading up to the apprehension of whoever killed Seth Rich." And I said to myself, wow, Julian has never, ever come even close to saying something about what could be one of his sources. But, I mean, you don't have to be a crackerjack analyst.
Ray, was this reward ever publicized in this country?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends. On the web, you could see it. On the New York Times, no. So this thing was shoved under the rug, and I think that's pretty clear that he had access to this kind of information. And my guess is that when he saw the content, and again, the content has been obfuscated, when he saw the content which indicated that Hillary Clinton stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders, she and her pals in the Democratic National Committee, that some of those young people got outraged. And they said, wow, you know, people in this country need to know about this. Stuck in a little thumb drive, downloaded the stuff, and got it to Julian Assange somehow. It never went over the web. And so there are no intercepted messages.
Ray, a very quick question.
Sure.
How can anybody get information to Julian Assange? I mean, he's in this embassy, and he's probably guarded. And I mean, they must have an electronic iron curtain around the place. How does stuff get to him?
Well, that's exactly right. They do have that iron curtain, and that's why, that's an extra reason why it could not have been a hack, because a hack could not get through that iron curtain. Now, I've been there. I was just there on the 4th of November, right? You know, what kind of search was done to me? They took my cell phone. They took, they took my license. They didn't search me. People come to visit Julian all the time. It's not very hard to, you know, stick a thumb drive in your bra or something like that. So this is all guesswork, but it's very convincing, in my view, that it was a leak and not a hack. If it were a hack, and as they would know about it, they don't know about it. And it's very interesting in this most recent statement that whereas the CIA and the FBI have high confidence in all this, the NSA, and they're the ones that have the intercepted emails, they have moderate confidence, which means we're guessing, and the other ones are feeling a little bit more secure in their guesswork. It's a travesty. I've never been more embarrassed by what's happened to the intelligence community in my whole life.
Well, and this is what I want to get back to, because I'm fascinated by the catch-22 that they find themselves in, where 20 years ago, they could have made these claims, said we have to redact or classify sources and methods. We can't tell you how we know it. We just know it, and people would have believed them. Now they cannot convince the majority of the American people. So what is going on inside the culture of the intelligence community, particularly the CIA, not the people at the in the leadership who can really alter culture and do things like Brennan is doing, but sort of the people who are doing the grunt work, the people on the country desks, the people who are actually doing the collection, who I would assume find themselves astride a gulf between their commitment to doing intelligence and the political people who run the agencies.
That's very perceptive, Joe, because there is this gulf. Brennan is not liked except by the sycophants that wind their way up toward the managerial ranks. He's, as a matter of fact, pretty much detested, especially because he's so political. Not only that, of course, he was a great advocate of kidnapping, otherwise known as extraordinary rendition for torture. He was involved in the torture itself. My dilemma is trying to figure out how it is that Brennan had such a hold on candidate Obama when he joins Obama's campaign in June of 2008, first thing that happened was Obama said, you know, I was going to vote against that that law to hold the telecommunications giants harmless for what they did. Now I think I'll vote for it. Whoa, that tipped me off. This guy was malleable, or he was impressionable, or John Brennan said, look, this is the way it is. This is the way it is. And so he didn't move against the torturers. Some of them are still there. You see them in the cafeteria, for God's sake. And then, you know, the telling thing is, and nobody knows this because nobody played it but The Guardian from London, when that Senate Intelligence Committee report of 4 years that relied on CIA cables to show the heinous nature of the torture that happened under CIA tutelage, when that was just about ready to be released, Obama fought it tooth and nail in defense of Brennan. We're talking about the end of 2014, just before the Senate changed hands into Republican hands. Now, Dianne Feinstein, to her great credit, said, look, Mr. President, I'm going to insist that this thing get out. It's been redacted, but it's bad enough. We're going to get it out. And if you don't get it out, Mark Udall here, Senator Udall, who actually lost the last election and
yes,
has
nothing
more to lose, he's going to read it on the Senate floor. So that's your choice, Mr. President. You let out the executive summary or you get the whole nine yards. Wow, that's a gutsy lady. What she was doing was standing up for her grandchildren, you know, sort of Mama Bear. These are guys that worked 4 hard years to put this thing together on the basis of CIA cables, and now they're going to be thwarted, not on Dianne Feinstein's watch. And so she prevailed, and the president, he said, oh, all right, if Udall's going to read this, probably, oh, yeah, sure, we'll put it out. Now, that was so bad, that report, that very few people have been able to read it all the way through. And when I had a chance on the talk show to confront Hoekstra, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee at the time, I said, you know, probably you didn't know about the torture. He said, no, I knew all about it. I said, oh, so you were too embarrassed to tell me? No, I know. I checked with my staff just before I came in here, he said, and they told me that we knew about 90% of what's in that report. And I said, oh, that's terrible. You're supposed to be overseeing these people. Well, the lawyers in the White House said it was okay.
Joe, are you having trouble with your mic?
No, I can't hear Mr. McGovern at all.
No.
There he is.
Ray, are you okay? We lost you for a minute.
Yeah, we lost you just as you were going into the most important details about the cover-up of the most difficult to swallow portions of the torture report, which, you know, we would all in an NSA dominated world kind of have to shrug our shoulders at.
No, I'm afraid it was my charger here. I thought we were going to use my home phone line, but that didn't work either. But now I can talk. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. You're fine now. Go ahead, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, let me ask you something.
Sure.
Ray. It seemed to me that one of the things that happened during the W administration is that Dick Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld hung the CIA out to dry to have them be the whipping boy for the intelligence when there was actually conflict inside the CIA, at least from the reports that I read. And they were basically willing to sacrifice the CIA in no small part because they wanted to move a lot of those covert functions that had been curtailed after the 70s, after the Church Commission. They wanted to move a lot of those functions to DIA, to NSA, to the Total Information Awareness Network under John Poindexter, and to farm out a lot of these covert activities and rendition and torture to private corporations like CACI and so on. So do you see Brennan as a recovery of the CIA or as a continuing dysfunction of what the CIA was going through during the Bush administration?
I think it's continuing. What Brennan has done was pretty much to join what used to be our analysis group together with the operators. And I'm told that most of the analysts now are targeteers, you know. They get little bits of information and they give it to the drone people. And they say, you know, this looks like this might be a terrorist. See what you think from 20,000 feet up. So it's really been very, very difficult to watch the degradation of not only estimates, but the current intelligence. And the people in charge just seem to, you know, be thwarted unless they want to cross swords with John Brennan. And, of course, that way you might not get promoted or you might not get keep your job. So it's a very sad situation. I've not seen it so bad. There was one exception after the Iraq estimate. Someone said, well, you know, Bush and Cheney are going after Iran now. Let's get somebody honest in to do a national intelligence estimate on Iran, see how close they are to getting a nuclear weapon. Well, they had to look all over the place. They got a fellow, Tom Finger. He was an assistant secretary of state for intelligence. He came in. He worked all throughout 2007, bottom-up assessment, and in November, they concluded Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. Whoa.
Wow.
Now, that estimate got out, and you don't have to believe me. Just look at Bush's memoir. He says this was an eye-popping estimate. It deprived me of the military option, for how could I possibly authorize a war on a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program? Bummer. God, it was just awful. He must have written that thing himself. You know, would think they were really scared about that. They would have said, hey, call the Israelis, tell them, wow, that there's no threat anymore. They stopped. Now, the reality was that the Iranians stopped, and that was that assessment was renewed and reiterated every year in the yearly brief. But the neocons, they still went after the Iranians, and they let loose this Stuxnet.
Yeah.
Which was the first, this terrible thing, because it let that genie out of the bag. This is the first real cyber warfare. And what it was intended to do, and I learned this just recently, the Israelis said, we don't believe that they stopped working on a nuclear weapon, so we're going to attack them. And instead of saying, oh, no, you're not, we said, oh, let's see, we got some imaginative guy. I know what we'll do. We'll sabotage their fabrication facilities, where they have their gaseous, if you will, whatever those big tubes are.
The centrifuges.
We'll put the centrifuges, and we'll put a worm in there, and we'll blow them up. And they did. They also blew up about five Iranian scientists.
Yeah, and active assassination program.
Yeah, so why? Never did you see any acknowledgement in the New York Times or any other place that they had stopped their nuclear weapons development program. And, it was just a lot of fun and games, and the Israelis wanted us to do that. And the way I heard this explained just last week was this was necessary to buy off the Israelis to make sure they didn't attack Iran. So there you have it. Those things happen in Washington, and that's one of the flies in the ointment.
Ray, do you think at this late date, since Israel got Bush to do their bidding probably in Iraq and got Hillary to do their bidding in Libya, if they on their own felt, well, the United States is not with us, if they took it upon themselves, this insanity, to attack Iran, do you think what do you think would happen?
Well, that's what the policymakers were so concerned about. No one had the guts, Bush, Cheney, or later Obama, to stand up to the Israelis and say, look, no way are you going to do that. If you do that, you're on your own. Instead of that, they say, oh, how can we dissuade the Israelis from doing this? I know what we'll do. We'll blow up their centrifuges. I know what we'll do. We'll kill their scientists. And those were joint programs with the Israeli service. And in very myopic terms, they worked, even though they were, in broader terms, completely unnecessary. And you wonder why the Iranians don't like us? I mean, hello. I think you can figure it out.
Joe, I want your closing thoughts on that. And one last question. In your news vandal, which is really wonderful today, you talk about the fact, I mean, it is obvious since they murdered John Kennedy that there has been never any interest in If there is no kind of American domestic policy with this government. Everything is foreign policy. And you say in your news vandal that the Democrats may go 180 degrees on foreign policy. Why do you say that? And also, what do you think would happen if Israel attacked Iran on their own?
Yeah, well, I didn't say that. I think that's Ryan Cooper in The Week. And, well, look, because the easiest thing to be in is in opposition. And this is what Trump is going to find out, and this is what the Republicans are going to find out. When you're in opposition to the presidency, you have a lot of leeway. And so, you know, here we have this situation where we don't – I mean, Trump is a cipher. I was actually going to ask Ray about Mike Pompeo, who is slated to be the next DNI, I believe. You know, he's going to go over to CIA. He's a pro-torture and he's a hardliner. The thing is, we don't know. We don't really know how this is going to play out. To what extent is Donald Trump actually using this as a negotiation starting point? Because ultimately what Trump wants to do is radically increase the size of the Navy and have basically the United States putting out sort of a World War II size Navy out on the seas. And I also think he's trying to repeal and replace Russia with China, which I think is a huge development. And I think one of the things you're seeing here is that the intelligence community and the foreign policy establishment in general is trying to put parameters around Trump because they do not want to switch the focus of their animus from Russia to China, because Russia is actually, it's not even a top five military spender now. It's just dropped out of the top five. China is a much different kettle of fish than Russia, and a much more supple and powerful power with a lot of money and something called the New Silk Road, trillions of dollars of investment they've been making over the last 10 years around the world. As for the attack on, so, you know, where are they going to come? Is this going to be the pro-Cold War party now? Is it going to, or if Donald Trump ends up getting incited into something, which I think an incitement from Iran is the one place where we all of us who observe are most concerned with, because Donald Trump seems to have a desire to focus his belligerence not only on China but on Iran. And considering how closely he seems to be aligning now with Netanyahu and with Israel, it all seems to make a lot of sense. And actually, that would be the one flashpoint between Donald Trump and Putin, because Iran has basically been an alliance with Putin more or less, but there are rifts there. Now that Erdogan is moving in with Putin, Putin could maybe cut loose the Iranians because there are things going on there. So Iran, to me, is still the most worrisome flashpoint, because I could tell you this: if Israel were to do something on their own, or there were to be any kind of coalition between the United States and Israel, or at least a nod and a wink from the United States to Israel, going into Iran is going to be unlike any of these easy, and I say easy with sort of a knowing understanding that they become sort of cancers, they metastasize over time. But going after Saddam Hussein's Iraq was basically going after a limping power with almost no capability and no national cohesion. The Iranian people, they're a people with about 4,000 years of history and with a stiff spine. And if the United States and or Israel were to ever get engaged in a war with Iran, there would be body bags. It would be more like Vietnam than it would be like the Iraq War.
That's quite correct. And, you know, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, he was asked about what would happen if the Iranians closed the straits there. And he said, quite frankly, well, they'd be closed. And then the next question was, well, you could have reopened them, right? And Mullen said, well, yeah, it'll take a couple of days. Now, Mullen did not want to be in the position of ordering Marines up those cliffs, right?
That's right.
That's why when that estimate came out, it was Mullen, in my view, that sort of got the president convinced that he had to release it publicly with a sanitized version. But once it was released, all the impetus for an attack on Iran dissipated. And that's where we are now, except that it's even more so,
because we have that agreement, not just between us and Iran, but between everyone on the Security Council, plus West Germany, all of whom want to do a lot of business with Iran. There are 80 million people there for peace.
That's right.
So it's not going to be an easy thing for Trump if he's so misguided as to want to make a war or create a more hostile or go back on that treaty. It's not going to be easy because the others are not going to follow him, and there will be no ostracizing or the sanctions that we would impose, the Iranians would be able to get around. There's no earthly reason why we have to have
it. Yeah. Ray and Joe, it is really not going to be easy to say goodnight. I mean, you guys are so, so interesting. Ray, a couple of things. First of all, I would love to have you come back semi-regularly here. You're so interesting. Where can folks go to look at some of those wonderful videos and speeches that you give?
Well, my son Joseph has done a website for me, and it's not hard to remember. It's simply raymcgovern.com.
And okay, then tell us quickly about Joe's documentary.
Oh, yeah, he's done this documentary. It's called The Other Side Documentary, all one word, .com. And it's the result of two crisscross journeys over the United States in which he self-described as a tree-hugging liberal, meets with Tea Party and other very conservative people and listens to them. It's really quite, I'm not unprejudiced, of course, but it's very enlightening what happens when people feel like they're listened to.
And where can people go to see it?
And it's just one word. You can get it for free on the web. It's one word, theothersidedocumentary.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for a great half. I was going to say half hour. It's been an hour and 5 minutes. Joe, are you on Ocelli again tomorrow?
Yeah, I'll be on Ocelli tomorrow. And then, of course, Inside the Headlines with News Vandal Friday on KRUU-FM. Go to newsvandal.com, newsvandal.com, spelled like it sounds. A little screen will pop up. You can sign up for the rundown. You'll get it 5 days a week. It's harder than ever before because Donald Trump is filling up the news cycle with tweets. But, I mean, this guy's making a lot of work for me. That's all I got to say. So, but it's there. And then right now on Consortium News, just a couple of days ago, my most recent piece, Donald Trump's debt to Willie Horton. It's a long piece. It's a long read, but it's kind of the history of how racially encoding has altered politics since the end of Jim Crow, and how Donald Trump inherited a set of techniques from Lee Atwater and used them to great effect. That's on Consortium News right now.
That's
a great piece.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you both very, very, very much. And thank you all for listening. As Edmure used to say, good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.